reaching from way down here.
Yeah.
From way down here.
Welcome to Thread, a podcast designed to explore God's story and lead you into a full life in Christ.
Thank you for joining us in this conversation, co-hosted by myself, Hannah D'Souza, and Dr. David Pachter.
Though I'm way down here, I get a better view of this boundless world that I'm going to.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Thread. We are in episode 30, which is the last episode in this series, God's Land Established. And today our episode is on the book of Ruth, which I'm excited about. It's actually one of two books in the Bible to be named after a woman, with the other, of course, being Esther. So we have a very special guest with us that we're very excited to introduce, and it's Cherie Gale.
Yay.
So welcome, Cherie.
Welcome, Cherie.
Hi, friends.
We would love you to share with everyone listening a little bit about yourself and where you're coming from.
Sure. So hi, everybody. My name is Cherie Gale. I am a PhD candidate at Georgetown University, and I'm studying theology and religious studies. I'm about to write a dissertation that I'm really excited about. I also serve in my local congregation in Baltimore as a teacher, which I love doing that. And I also get to teach classes at Georgetown. In fact, I have a fellowship for the upcoming school year to do some teaching on my research in Doha in Qatar. So wow. That's my life and that's my world.
That's amazing. So good to have you.
Thank you
we're
for
honored
having
to
me.
Have you with us. Cherie's a friend of ours, and it's really fun. We had a lot of fun even preparing this episode, so it's going to be a great conversation. So one of the reasons that I'm excited about this is the voice of women and the important role that they play. We may have talked about this beforehand, I can't remember, but in my own research, I ended up doing a lot of work on the memoirs of women. I find that women have a way of expressing things in ways men don't. They can actually articulate and often express what's going on in the moment. Men tend to need to get through the whole thing and then look back and go, what just happened? And then they can talk about it. So that's why it was really helpful even in, you know, looking at spirituality and how women discuss and talk about their spiritual lives. So that was great. Now, this topic, this has been an interesting experience for me. And the reason is in my entire life in the church, I don't think I have ever heard a sermon preached on the book of Ruth.
What? Wow.
I think that's true. I really think that's true. Now, I think it's unfortunate that that's been the case, of course, because this is such a rich book and important story. But yeah, I was just thinking, I don't know that I've heard this preached. If it's happened, it certainly hasn't happened enough that it's a familiar story. So I'm really glad we're devoting an entire episode to this and that we have the two of you to help guide this conversation. So what I wanted to do as we started is just to ask each of you, why is the story of Ruth meaningful to you? So Cherie, why don't we start with you? What is it about this story that you love?
Well, I'm actually going to say four reasons why I loved the depiction of these women in relationship with each other and with their communities and with God. The first reason is I love that these are women, these are men, and they're human, and they're having this human experience, but they're having it in front of and under a divine God. And to me, I mean, that's me, that's my life. I'm a human being with my own faults and, you know, things about me that are not so savory. And I'm living my life before and under God. The second thing that I really love about this book is that it does feature and highlight women, two women in their devotion to each other. And it's really quite fascinating, actually. Can I mention my quote? A quote from Robert Alter, who writes the book Art of Biblical Narrative. He says about Ruth, or the story of Ruth, he says that the author has rotated the betrothal type scene, or sort of the picture or the frame, he rotates it 180 degrees based on gender and geography. So the protagonist is a heroine, not a hero. And her homeland is Moab, the foreign soil on which she meets her future spouse or mate. And it's not Judea. And furthermore, she, a woman, is given something to drink from young men. And if we're familiar with sort of the well imagery from, think about Rebecca, the men are always being supplied water to drink by women. But in this case, Ruth, her thirst is quenched by the men in her life. So I just find that really fascinating what the author is doing here in the book of Ruth. The third thing is that these are people who they protest in different ways, but they protest and God allows them to. And then the final thing is just the fact that there's no other book in the Bible that is named after a woman who is not a Jew, who is not an Israelite. And so this is just it's just really rich with just a lot of lessons to learn. There's so much to sink your teeth into. We're not going to cover all of the things just in our time here, but those are just some things that I really love about this book.
It's amazing. Love that. Fantastic. Hannah, how about you?
Oh, I love what you shared. I don't have four things, but I will expand on your last point. Because I think that for me has always been what struck me about this book is that significance of Ruth being a foreigner, being a Moabite woman. We've gone through the Torah so far in this series, and we've already crossed Deuteronomy, but in Deuteronomy 23, verse 3, we see a prohibition of God that the Moabites, along with Ammonites, would be banned from entering the assembly of God. And I think we see in Ruth's story, it kind of demonstrates that those commands were not God denouncing those races or ethnicities. I know we spoke about this a bit in our episode on Joshua with Michael Burns, but rather at the core was a religious issue. So it was more about not intermarrying with people who worshipped false gods, and so not leading the Israelites astray, that command. And what we see with Ruth is a reminder of, again, a thread we've seen already of the righteous non-Israelite and the foreigner who is not part of the chosen people by birth, but through faith gets to be grafted into the story. And I love that about this book.
Very cool. So let's do a little kind of set the tone here for our listeners about what's happening with the story. There's some kind of key things to draw out here as we get into this story. It's four chapters, this book. Most scholars classify it as short story, you know, so it kind of has this power to stand alone in the its narrative stands alone in a lot of ways. It's really all about the critical human relationship dynamic that the Old Testament does talk about quite a bit, called Hesed. And for those that aren't familiar with that concept, it's most often translated directly into English as loving kindness, but it means a lot more than that. There's this idea of this joint obligation and relationship that reflects closeness, solidarity, loyalty, intimacy, and that's really what this story highlights, is the role and value of Hesed, and really how that's at the heart of this spirituality that we're describing.
And if I may, something which I love that you pointed that out, Dave, just this idea of joint obligation. I think that's really key. This idea of Hesed, it doesn't just happen. While it can happen in any relationship, it really exists in a covenantal setting, under a covenantal framework. And there's this idea of reciprocity, right? And so if you are extended that Hesed, you absolutely extend it to others, right? And so it sort of operates and functions in this loop of gratitude, loving kindness. And I think that's important, and I think we see a lot of that in the book of Ruth, where there's just this circle of giving and kindness, this extension first from God and through the characters in the story.
It's great. Yeah, that's, and it's why this is such an important story. It's something we don't talk nearly enough about in our walk. So I also want to talk about the importance of the Hebrew language and how it works in this story. So part of what's really fun about this is that most of the names in this story have very direct meanings in the Hebrew language. So if a Hebrew speaker were to hear this story told, the way that they would hear this story carries meaning because of the way that the names work in this narrative. So let's walk through some of those. So one of our first characters is Elimelech. His name means "My God is King," and he is married to Naomi, who becomes a really integral part of the story. Naomi means pleasant or kindness or sweet, and that becomes important because later she renames herself Mara, which means bitter. So there's this contrast. She starts sweet, she turns bitter, and that's all part of the narrative that plays out. But I think my favorite part is the name of the two sons. So they have two boys, Mahlon and Chilion. Mahlon means illness or sickly, and Chilion means coming to an end or frail. Now, I'm sure, well, I won't explain that in detail. We're just going to have to see how that plays out. We'll hold on. So then these two boys, when they end up in Moab, get married, and the women that they marry also have wives where their name carries meaning. One of them marries Orpah, which means back of the neck, or one who turns her back. And then the second one marries Ruth, which, as we know, is the primary character in the story, which means water that refreshes. So here's what I think would be really good for us to do. As we read the first five verses of this narrative, I want to ask Kanna to read it. Instead of saying the names, I'm going to have her say it the way Hebrew people would hear the story being told, with these characters' names actually with what they mean in the Hebrew language. So this ought to give us a little context of what's going on in this story. So Hannah, how about if you read Ruth 1:1-5?
In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to live in the country of Moab, he and his wife and two sons. The name of the man was "My God is King," and the name of his wife, "Kindness." And the names of his two sons were "Sickly" and "Frail." They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But "My God is King," the husband of Kindness, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one of them was "One Who Turns Her Back," and the name of the other, "Water That Refreshes." When they had lived there about 10 years, both Sickly and Frail also died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband.
Okay, so we can see really quickly how these names take on a character that they represent in the story and how important that is. So the first thing we see is that there's a famine in the land. You know, it's interesting. Famine is something really hard for us in the West to understand, where there is so little food that you would be willing to move countries to find something to eat. And that's really the backdrop of what's happening here. So this Israelite family leaves Israel and goes to this foreign country, Moab, and their sons end up growing up there and taking wives from Moab. So one of these women will be a source of refreshment, the other will not. And this setting ends after Elimelech dies, the boys die. And so here we have these four women now in Moab. And so you've got three, Naomi, Orpah, and Ruth, but they're in a tough place. So in this culture, and Sri, I think this is going to be great to have you kind of weigh in here about what's going on. So in this culture, three unwed women now have to make some tough decisions about what they're going to do. So I would love for you to explain a little bit. First of all, what does it mean for a woman without a husband in this culture? What would her options be? How would she be viewed? And then I think this also ties into where the story goes, which is what were the expectations and duties and responsibilities of the men in regard to the women in their lives that end up in these situations where they're unmarried. So can you shed a little bit of light on that for us?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm sure we've all heard of this, right? Like, women were property and women really didn't have sort of their own autonomy in those days. And I think while, yes, that there is truth to that, I think that also flattens the position of women a bit, either to by not explaining or not demonstrating just how vulnerable these women would be, or by also not highlighting the responsibility of the men in their lives to step up in situations like this. And so, you know, when we think about culture and we think about what it means for people when they get together and they have to live together, it's really important to understand that we have to come to some sort of agreement, right? We have to come to some sort of arrangement as we are deciding to subsist next to each other. And because of that, we're going to have laws, or we're going to have agreements that are made into laws. And then there are agreements that are not going to rise to the level of becoming law. And in this particular case, there are laws that would govern what a woman, or what women like Naomi, Ruth, and Orpah, what they could do, or what was available to them. Ultimately, they would need to find themselves back under the care of a male patriarch. So that's the ultimate goal, but that wouldn't necessarily be a route or an avenue open to a lot of women. And so based on your social location, so for Naomi, she's a foreigner in a foreign land. She has no male relatives at all. And so there are a few things that she could do. I mean, she could become a prophetess if that was her gift and calling, but it doesn't appear that that's open or available to her. Prostitution was another route that women could take. And when I say prostitution, I know, you know, we might sort of get the hairs on the back of our necks up in a tizzy, but this was a legitimate profession for women in a world, one, that they had very little to do with structuring its laws. So that was an option, or slavery would be a potential option for them. So ultimately, I don't know if that sort of paints a picture for the options that these women would have available to them. But these were viable routes for women to take, women who were not, or did not have that manly tie. And it would really be the responsibility of a clan leader or a king or whomever to make sure that there were positions for these women to fit into. So even the things that I've named, like, these were legitimate roles that rulers would make sure the most vulnerable had access to. So,
well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That Naomi would then hear that there's food in Judah and want to go back because she's going to have relatives there, right?
Yes.
So this puts her back in a position where she could be taken care of. So she tells her daughters-in-law, here, you go back to your mother's house. I'm going to go back to my family in Judah. And of course, they have a tearful exchange. Orpah, the one who turns her back, does return to her mother's house. And I want to just really quickly, could you just share? I know it says they go back to their mother's house, not their father's house. Can you explain why that's significant?
Yeah, sure. No, that's I'm really glad that you pointed that out. One, because like I mentioned before, for women in this position to subsist, to live, they would need to form or make connections with ruling men. And by ruling, I don't mean king, but so the head male of a household or of a clan group or a tribe or something of that sort. But in this instance, Naomi, who is going through some things, feeling some stuff, you know what I mean? And I don't know if this is what's playing in. This is totally speculative. But at the end of the day, she tells both the girls, go back to your mother's house. That is not ancient Near East practice. You don't go back to the home of your mother. You go back to your father's house. you go back to the patriarch. And while I'm not sure why she does that, the effect of this is that this is a woman's book. This book is helping us to see into the world of women, into the lives of women. And so the fact that Naomi instructs her daughters-in-law in this way is quite instructive about whose story we're entering into.
Thanks for explaining that, Cherie. Let's move to Ruth 1. This is one of the most important and well-known actual parts of the... So here we now have Ruth saying exactly how she feels about this. So could you read that for us, Hannah?
Yeah. So in Ruth 1:16, it says, "Do not press me to leave you, to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do this to me and more as well, if even death parts me from you." Yeah, this is a passage we most often hear recited at weddings, but it is amazing that the context of this is Ruth to Naomi. It's two women, it's friendship. Would you add, I guess, Cherie, to the significance of this kind of famous passage in Ruth?
Well, not only is it one woman's expression of devotion to another, it's a conversion speech. And so in this speech, she's giving up her culture, her cultural practice, and that necessarily includes her religious devotion. So she's devoting herself to the God of Naomi. And real quickly, the scholar Phyllis Tribble, she compares Ruth and Abraham. So where in Abraham, God is the one who chooses Abraham, in this instance, Ruth chooses God. And where God makes a promise to Abraham to leave his land, Ruth has no promise. And she is going back to the land from which Abraham came. So just amazing stuff in here.
Well, it's very moving, even to see this as a conversion speech. I remember visiting Israel and being on a bus going to Bethlehem, and the tour guide pointed out through the window the mountains of Moab, and they were so far away in the distance. And I remember thinking in that moment, wow, Ruth really left home when she was heading off to Israel and to Bethlehem. She was very unlikely she'd be returning. And that journey on foot is 7 to 10 days walk. And I imagine how maybe on the journey, Naomi told Ruth the stories about Yahweh along the way. But I love the way you've described this. So then we see the two of them in the narrative return to Bethlehem. And then the Bible says that the whole town is kind of stirred upon their arrival. So I guess they remembered Naomi even after all those years. And the women ask, is this Naomi or is this kindness? As we've talked about the meaning of the names in Hebrew. And then she responds very poignantly, call me Mara. So don't call me kindness. Don't call me pleasant. Call me bitter, which is a strong thing to say. And then we can read this verse here in Ruth 1:21, where Naomi says, I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? Why call me kindness when the Lord has dealt harshly with me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?
I found this really fascinating part of the story because she says she walked away full, or she went away from Israel full. Now, clearly she left because of the famine. So she was not physically full. She was hungry. That's what drove her out of the country. But she left with relationships. She left with a full kind of spirituality, right? And she goes to this foreign land and she says, now she's coming back empty. I just find that interesting that this human fulfillment is actually coming from someplace else that's really brought out in this story. It even goes on as we transition into Ruth chapter 2. And this is where we start getting into a lot of the important cultural pieces. Hannah, you want to read Ruth 2, the first two verses?
Now, Naomi had a kinsman on her husband's side, a prominent rich man of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain behind someone in whose sight I may find favor. She said to her, go, my daughter.
So obviously we don't use the word kinsman today.
Wait,
maybe
you
could explain that. Nah, I don't. It's not part of my normal vocabulary.
You do in England.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding.
Oh, no, but kinsman.
So maybe there's two kind of things here if you could quickly clarify for us, Sri. One is, what's a kinsman? And two, what does it really mean for her to glean behind someone and to find favor from them?
So actually, this term kinsman or goel in Hebrew, we find a regulation for it in Leviticus 25, verse 23-25. And that scripture says the land must not be sold permanently, speaking about land, because the land is mine. This is God speaking. And you reside in my land as foreigners and strangers. Throughout the land that you hold as a possession, you must provide for the redemption of the land. If one of your fellow Israelites becomes poor and sells some of their property, their nearest relative or their goel, their kinsman, is to come and redeem what they have sold. The kinsman redeemer, it's tied to the land, right? And Naomi does have land, we'll see that. And so the person, this male figure, is her closest relative, and that person is to make sure that the property, one, stays within the tribe, and two, ultimately ends back up with its original owner, right? And then gleaning laws, real quickly, I can say Leviticus 19 talks about that. I won't read it for the sake of time. But again, it's amazing how when we look at these passages, there's such concern for the lowest, the most vulnerable, I should say, in society. And the gleaning laws basically state that for harvesters or landowners or farmers, they can't sort of be greedy and take all the harvest. The stuff that falls, God says that belongs to the widow, the orphan, and the alien.
And that's where her following behind would mean she could kind of pick up what gets dropped, right, to feed her self. So we see her approach Boaz. Boaz is apparently the redeemer, the kinsman, but they actually don't get it right, which comes out in the story. So Boaz, what's interesting about Boaz, it's one of the only names in the story that doesn't have an additional meaning. It's just Boaz. Of course, he takes notice of Ruth back there gleaning in the field. He asks about her. He shows kindness towards her. He puts protections around her. And then, you know, she's curious. She wants to know why he showed favor. And he acknowledges this Hesed relationship that he sees. He sees her faithfulness to Naomi. And he allows her access, not just to what falls, but now he gives her access to the actual stalks of grain. So he's saying, you don't have to just pick up what falls. You can actually go to the stalks of grain and take some home with you. Sends her home with an ephah of barley, which I had to look up how much is that. It's about 10 days worth of grain for the two of them. So that was a significant amount that she takes home. So she goes back to Naomi and she's, you know, Naomi's surprised. Wow, he showed you a lot of favor. And why is that? And then she says, go back. Like, this is a good setup for us. And she does. In fact, for two real kind of seasons, the barley and the wheat is harvested. So barley's harvested in April in that part of the world. Wheat's harvested in May. So for 2 months, they had access to food before they sorted out the rest of what's going to happen in this story. Which brings us to chapter 3, Hannah.
Yeah, so chapter 3 begins with Naomi wanting to secure a more long-term solution for Ruth. And so we see in this chapter her give Ruth very specific instructions to go down to the threshing floor and wait until Boaz eats and drinks and goes to lie down. And then Ruth is to uncover his feet and wait. Now, there's a lot going on here that we will not understand completely. But Sri, I'm wondering if you can shed some light on what's happening here. I know for many, this might be considered kind of a scandalous act on Ruth's part. So what are we to make of it?
Well, it is rather scandalous, but and we don't have time to go into the details of this, but the way that Naomi prompts Ruth to wash, to not be seen, to wait till he's imbibed, you know, till he's he's really intoxicated. What's being set up here? One scholar calls this sort of a bedroom type scene. And we see different women sort of do something similar. Tamar does something similar with Judah. We see in Genesis 38. But what we sort of gloss over when we read, this is a very intimate exchange. And if we were to sort of peel back the text, there's more than just a man and a woman lying down taking place here. That's all, Leslie.
Yeah, well, it becomes clear because Boaz responds and he says he's impressed with her that she's not pursuing younger men. So clearly he knows she's pursuing me here.
Right.
And not the younger men. So we know that there was something else happening there. But yeah. Boaz raises a red flag and he goes, yeah, you thought I was the kinsman redeemer. I'm actually not. Someone else has first dibs here. So he sends her away with more grain, but he really wants to make sure that they sort this out in front of the elders of the town. And that's where chapter 4 begins. Chapter 4, they're back in the village. They're in front of the elders. The next of kin, who does have first rights of refusal or first dibs, sits down. And what was his name? He has a fun Hebrew name too.
His Hebrew name translates to so and so.
Love that. The so and so sits down.
Oh, cool guy.
Obviously, it's not Boaz. It's so and so. And so we get into this whole conversation about the redeeming this inheritance. And so-and-so's interested in redeeming the inheritance until he figures out that Ruth comes with the property. And then he says he can't redeem it. So Sri, what are we to make of that?
So technically it's Naomi that comes with the property, right? If there was anyone to be married, it's Naomi. And this idea of what it would mean for this gentleman, for so-and-so to redeem the property, he would need to marry, right? Now, Naomi's offering up Ruth in her stead. But this marrying within your family, it's what's known as levirate marriage. And really what it is, it's a substitutionary marriage, right? We see this again with Tamar and Judah, where Judah's sons die. And Tamar it's her right to marry and to stay within that family. And ultimately, scholars think that this was done to keep resources within the tribe, within the clan. If she goes out and marries someone else, the patriarch would need to pay a bride price for her since she is his daughter. And so ultimately, that's sort of what this is all about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, and then we see Boaz going through this whole process of, he follows the local customs, he inquires the inheritance, he does it in front of the elders, it's all up and up, it's all on the up and up, and he acquires then Naomi and all that belonged to Elimelech, all that belonged to the two sons, frail and sickly. He also acquires Ruth to be his wife. And that means that his name will be on the inheritance. So this is witnessed by the people. It's blessed in this transaction. So Boaz now becomes Ruth's husband, and they conceive together and have a son. The women in the community hear about this, and of course, they're part of this whole process, and they come to Naomi and they say, this really neat statement here in Ruth 4:14. Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without next of kin, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has borne him. And so we see this kind of empty, full connection that we saw earlier come back full circle. Yahweh is the restorer of fullness of life. And they name this son Obed. This new baby Obed becomes someone very important in the future story. Hannah, do you want to describe who he becomes?
Yeah, so he will be King David's grandfather. And I think it's amazing that David's great-grandmother was a Moabite woman named Ruth, and that this foreigner will find herself in the lineage of not just David, but the Messiah. And we see that in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 1, verse 5, Ruth is named there in that lineage. Another thing I love about this book is just Boaz calling Ruth a woman of noble character in chapter 3, verse 11. And we know the other place that phrase is used is in Proverbs 31, which we know well, where Solomon will talk about the wife of noble character. And I wonder if he thought about his great-great-grandmother when writing that. But I do think it's important that Ruth is called this by Boaz before she's influential, before she's a mother, before she's a wife. And in the canonical order of the Hebrew Bible, Ruth actually comes after Proverbs. So some scholars think she is kind of seen as this illustration after Proverbs 31 of what this woman might be like. And it speaks to her wisdom, her courage, her strength as an individual first. And this idea has actually been on my mind recently, because I had a friend from class come with me to church a couple of weeks ago, and he loved the service, loved the worship, loved the community. But something he mentioned to me after the service was, it seemed like conversion and marriage were the goals that we're meant to aspire to. And although it wasn't explicitly said, I don't think, in the service, but from various stories that were shared by people, I think both those things, afterwards I was reflecting on what he said, they were presented as kind of the climax or the end point that we strive to and nothing beyond that. And I think that's something we have to be wary of in church. I think marriage is a blessing, but being wary of not putting it on a pedestal beyond what the Bible does. And I think the goal really is knowing and walking faithfully with God. And that's what we see Ruth do before any of the additional blessings come. And I think that's why Boaz singles her out as this woman of noble character or of great valor. There's an article that Rachel Held Evans wrote on this idea, and she warns Christians today. She writes, "Be careful of focusing on marriage, motherhood, and domesticity when it is not our roles that define us, but the integrity and bravery we bring to those roles." I like that quote.
That's really, and I love that you bring out that the whole emphasis in the story is about who she was before she was redeemed, right? That's really what the story draws attention to. And that's even what Boaz noticed. I appreciate you bringing that out. Sheree, do you have any final wisdom you would like to impart with us before we wrap up today?
Yeah, I love what you just said, Hannah, about Ruth being called noble before marriage. And something that I want to, you mentioned this briefly, but I want to just highlight it. That word that gets translated as noble in Hebrew, it's chayil, and it means strong. And in the over 200 times that it shows up in the Hebrew Bible in the Old Testament, it's translated as strong, brave, valiant. The only times where it isn't is when it refers to women. When Boaz talks to Ruth, and in Proverbs 31. And that's a translator's choice. There is no imperative in the Hebrew that would make us choose that. And so I wanna highlight this, because Boaz complimenting this woman, he said, "You are strong." There's absolutely nothing wrong with being strong as women. You are brave.
That's really great.
And so, again, I love this. I love the reclamation of a strong and a brave femininity. Go, Ruth.
Mm-hmm. Go, Ruth.
In conclusion.
That is fantastic. So, Sheree, it's such a joy to have you with us. Really appreciate you coming on and sharing with
us
about your journey and what you're doing. And we had to catch you before you disappear over to Doha for a year. So thanks for making this happen and joining us. And Hannah, always great to see you. By the way, real quick, what's up with Gilgamesh? Just haven't asked you for a minute.
He's still alive there? And kicking. He's still there. All right. I'll bring him up front next episode.
Oh, okay.
Next series.
So this is the end of this series. We're now moving on to the United Kingdom. Hannah really likes that. She thought that was fun.
United Kingdom. It's a whole series in England.
Saul, David, and Solomon. So we're going to be moving into the period of the kings in our next series. So stay tuned. But thanks for joining us here on Thread. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you for joining this Thread conversation.
We're more than a podcast. Check out threadpodcast.org for more immersive content.
Though I'm waiting on here, I get a better view of this boundless world.